sit here staring out the window at the Mr. Fog or rain or whatever, I don't know.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. This is the Trees Reach podcast brought to you exclusively by Trees Reach. I am Luke.
I'm Dylan.
And I'm Riley.
And we are exclusively Trees Reach.
Yeah.
So today we are continuing this series where we talk about songs from our debut album. Some night you will hear me groaning. And
Okay.
Tonight we're talking about mist or fog or rain.
Nope. None of those.
None of those.
Do you know what we're talking? Luke, how much have you had to drink? Do you know what we're doing?
I had some Dairy Queen earlier.
Oh, wow.
That's the only thing that's on my mind. You know what I'm saying? No, the song that we were doing was formerly titled Mr. Fog or Rain. And now I don't remember the title. I'm put on the spot and it's just embarrassing.
Don't nobody tell him.
We're not going to tell Luke what the name of the song is.
No, can't pull up the track list, Luke. Shh. You got to do it by memory.
Skies and Seas, got it.
Nice.
Sailing the Skies and Seas. That's the song for today. I forgot to mention in the intro, as I stumbled my way through it, that if you haven't listened to this song, you should pause it right now and listen to the song. I meant to say that at the beginning. But
we're going to do the whole episode over again.
We're going to do it all over again. If you haven't listened to the song, end this episode and go listen to the song. Let's hit it off with Riley, who is our famous Trees Reach historian, for a little history lesson. Thank you, Riley.
Yeah. Thanks, Luke. Thanks for having me on the program tonight. It's a beautiful day here in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I will tell you about the history of Skies and Seas, since I was kind of the primary writer of this one. I think I started this... I guess I don't know exactly what year it was, but it started off, I just had the line, January tastes like everything I hate about myself, which, sung over the melody that I came up with, I just thought had a nice little ring to it.
It's pretty emo, all, Riley.
Yeah, it's super emo.
He wrote it in like 2002.
Yeah. Yeah, when I was 6 years old.
Yeah.
I already had like three pair of Hot Topic jeans. No, it was not then. It was later. But it's definitely emo. And I wrote it. Anybody who's heard this song can probably pick up on the Simon and Garfunkel influence. And that was definitely definitely in there. I was going through that kind of a feel. And I just had that one line, and I made a demo of that one line with the chord progression you hear repeated throughout the song going for a few bars, but I didn't really think much of it, I think. And I showed it to Dylan, and I remember Dylan being like, that's really cool, you should like finish that song. And I was like, you know what, I think I will. And I might have come up with a couple more things, like I think I came up with what the chorus could do. I wanted to stop, and like every measure would have like a big downbeat with like crash cymbals and such, maybe some horns. But I don't really remember much about what else I wrote in it before Dylan and I started working on it together. Dylan, could you pick up from there with some more details?
I think that you had written, so you had written those choruses, including the lyrics, by the time I jumped on to help you out with it. I think maybe you had no. I don't think you had anything in the verses besides January tastes like anything I hate, everything I hate about myself. Because I remember especially writing together that line, so I'll just sit here staring out the window at the mist or fog or rain or whatever, I don't know. Because I remember having I don't remember if I've mentioned this in earlier episodes, but one of the fondest and clearest memories I have from writing the songs on Some Night is Riley and I would often go walking out on this trail at night, this nature trail by my house that led to a park, and we would bring a couple guitars and a couple of Marley's Mellow Moods from the gas station up the street, and we would just talk about the album. We would write songs. We wrote this one there and Seven Stories and I'm Fine, and a couple others I'll probably remember when we get to them. But I remember walking up toward this, the trail kind of curves into this path that goes up a hill, and then there's a clearing in the hill, and we kind of like sit there, and like sometimes the moon would be out and we'd stare at the moon for a while. It was very romantic. And then we'd go up further, and there's this place where they've now developed it into condos, I think. But before it was developed, you could just sit on the edge and look out on the town and see like a Burger King or a Subway or something. I don't remember, but we'd sit up there and write stuff. And I remember writing that line up on that overhang. And I remember wanting the lyrics to have there's a certain quality that some Paul Simon songs have, where just the lyrics kind of keep cascading in phrases that you don't really expect, and he almost kind of talks through them a little bit or something, and they wind up at a place that's really satisfying, and he's just said something really good. And so we wanted a line that sort of suggested this resignation, or that kind of like aspired towards something that then turned around on itself and just kind of ended up at this spot over this extended musical phrase that sounded like satisfying in a similar fashion. I do think we did all those verses, both those verses, walk in. I think it took a few sessions. I don't think we did it all in one. I do remember you pointing me to a Sufjan Stevens song called The Mistress Witch of McClure from The Avalanche, which is the B-sides to his Illinois album. And the B-sides are almost as good as the Illinois album. Some of them are, at least. And I remember that song had a walking bass line. It was like kind of an up-tempo swung folk song. Really great lyrics and melody and really charming. And then you talked about how satisfying when this walking bass line came in.
And so I remember if you listen closer, you eventually realize that the walking bass line is just an ascending major scale, which is par for the course for Sufjan. But it works great. Sounds awesome.
It does. So I remember we were kind of... maybe that's an influence that people wouldn't recognize immediately listening to this song. So if you haven't heard The Mistress Witch of McClure by Sufjan Stevens, you should go listen to it because it's a very good song. And then,
you mentioned that the lyrics were good. And I actually just heard that song over the weekend when I was helping Willis move and was reminded at how like possibly disturbing and weird the lyrics are, which again, par for the course for Sufjan. But yeah. If anybody has any idea what that song is about, let me know so I can sleep better at night. It sounds like a very jolly song otherwise. Anyway, go on, Dylan. Sorry.
Riley, I remember you wrote that bass line that I ended up playing, which is the only instance in Trees Reach history where Riley has written my bass part for me. And it was because... you know, you obviously wanted a walking bass line. At this point, I wasn't really listening to jazz. I didn't really have too much of a category for that. And so it was probably the safer decision to make to have you just write a part. I remember having trouble with it. In fact, I remember we changed it a couple times because it was too hard for me to too hard for me to play.
Like we changed the parts in just in the verse?
No, just the part that you know, because the guitar does a little yeah, and it used to be I did that same rhythm on the bass going but that was I just couldn't do those skipping intervals. It was tough for me.
Yeah, I think it probably helps the groove to have you not do those anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But oh well. I mean, better luck next time, bud. You know, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Next time we record this song.
You'll adapt. Yeah.
Thanks for admitting that, Dylan.
You know. But no, thanks, guys. It's just, you know, you're doing your best, and that's fine. Like, you know, it's good enough. It's good enough, Dylan. It's good.
I honestly appreciate the support from you guys.
Anyway, so to keep the ball rolling. Dylan, I feel like this might be your domain. Maybe Riley, it is your domain as well. But where are we at in the concept for this song specifically? What's happening with the character? What's happening with the conscience? Because both people are here, right?
Yeah. So the narrator at this point, if you'll remember, after that first big dream song, he has sort of a change of pace, and he is starting to see beauty in things he didn't see beauty in, but it's all kind of the calm before this storm. It's setting up a downfall, and a song like Skies and Seas is highlighting, or maybe like kind of foreshadowing, the attitudes that are behind that downfall. So there is this element, well, in the first lyric, January tastes like everything I hate about myself. There's still this really, this element of self-hatred and even dependency. You know, January tastes like everything I love about your eyes. He's kind of talking about the girl. But then at the end he says, but the night is longer than the day when she is skies and seas away. That's meant to be heard as a good thing, because he's really just looking to get back to his dreams. He's really looking to find satisfaction in himself. We'll later find at the cost of relationships and just kind of shutting himself in. So that's where we're at in the concept now. I was looking at these lyrics earlier, and I mentioned in Mist the precipitation theme. The gradual mist is the first song in this vein, and then you have fog and then rain on disc two. And the idea is, again, these increasing levels of obscurity. And so as he sits there saying, you know, last night I was dreaming, the universe was kneeling at my feet, but morning came and swept me out of all the endless, overwhelming madness, the fantasies I tease. So I'll just sit here staring out the window at the mist or fog or rain or whatever, I don't know. So it's a way of saying that he's just, if he can't be there, he's going to spend all his time thinking about it and looking at it or whatever. That's where we're at story-wise. There's also this interesting lyric that popped out to me. Last night I was dreaming that seven swans were catching in the rye, which is a line that you wrote, Riley. And some earlier versions of the lyrics had more references to this, but we were, in addition to Peter Pan, we were also, Riley and I were into Catcher in the Rye at the time, and it's still a favorite for both of us. But that line stayed in there because we liked it. And actually the song Glass Cages, that whole concept that's about, like the book reads different now, the words don't seem so near, but like museum artifacts, they stay the same each year. All that changes is you, is from a concept that Holden Caulfield goes on a kind of an excursion about being in a museum and realizing everything feels different, but he's the only one that's changed, which is what that whole song is about. And he talks about, you know, these artifacts in glass cages, you know. Yeah, so I thought that remnant of a Catcher in the Rye reference was there. But I think the there was a voice of angst that, just as many people know who have read the book and been familiar with it for a long time, is I think really well articulated. And so we thought might as well not reinvent the wheel here and just kind of try to lean into that and take from it what we relate to and fit it into our own work.
Nice. Riley, do you have anything to add to that? Do you have anything to top Dylan is what I mean to say?
Not really. I think when I wrote the lyric, it was seven swans were catching in the rye. Like last night I was dreaming that seven swans were catching in the rye. It was supposed to, it's just kind of like dream speak. Like that's not, like in the book, the catcher in the rye is like protecting kids from falling off a cliff that they don't know is nearby. And seven swans is like a, sort of like, I think it's maybe biblical, but it's like a symbolic thing. And Sufjan Stevens has an album called Seven Swans. And so I was just kind of combining things for, as like nonsense dream speak with like a, admittedly lazy allusion to the book.
Well, you didn't have to tell them that.
Well, it's out there now. Can't take it back.
Well, Riley did it, not me. So I suppose I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
Do you guys have fond memories of playing this song live, or what are your thoughts on our live rendition of it?
I think that what we've done with it as Trees Reach is definitely the most fun it's ever been. But if you guys, we've only done it a couple times live, but we kind of changed the arrangement and like build things in more slowly. And then at the end it goes into this cathartic thing where Luke does like a halftime thing on the drums and Riley does a guitar solo. It's a lot of fun and it's kind of country. But it's one of these, so, okay, here's a confession time. We spend an inordinate amount of time pretending to be a good vocal band. you know what I mean? Oh, like, yeah. There are some bands you see, and it's like, man, these guys can just sing. And I think each of us awesome individually, can sing just fine. But when we try to sing harmony with each other into microphones coming through a PA, it's one of the most miserable experiences of all time. Like when we can't lock in those harmonies and can't for the life of us figure out how to make it sound better, and we'll like record ourselves and be like, all right, I think like I'm consistently sharp there, something like that. But it's so hard to find when you're just in that context. So that unfortunately is kind of what characterizes my memories of trying to do this song live, is just feeling like, man, I can't lock in with Riley's melody here. And it's kind of high in my register too, to be singing like a harmony that's like not overpowering the vocal or something, or the lead, I should say. But when we do get it, it's a hoot and a half.
And you're walking too.
I'm walking a bass line while trying to sing a harmony. That's very tough. Now, I've done that with other songs more successfully, but for some reason, this one is just is tough. I don't know what it is. What do you think, Riley?
I was wondering, have we ever played this song? Did we ever play this song before Luke joined the band?
Like, we did. You and I did. Play it,
like at open mics and stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't recall at all what we did for the arrangement. Do you? It can't have been very good, you know.
No, it probably wasn't that bad, but it probably wasn't anything better than silence. You know what I mean? Like, they could have also not listened to it. Just in the sense that, I don't mean that to be like overly self-deprecating, but it was probably just both of us had a guitar and we were both just throwing a capo on the first fret and playing A minor, D to G. That was probably the arrangement, and we sang the harmonies and probably did like all right, but not
yeah. Yeah, I definitely had more fun with it once we got Luke in there. Definitely. But this song is just really hard to sell
in
any capacity, which might just mean it's not a very good song, or we're just not very good at playing it. But it's really tough to do this one live and feel like, yeah, I bet people enjoyed that a lot, you know?
Yeah, go ahead, Luke.
I was going to say it feels like it needs more personnel. Like,
yeah,
the majority of times I remember doing it, it's just been us three. Maybe we had Travis in on one of the shows that we played it. But it gets to a point in the recording where it feels like a party. Like there's a lot happening in the choruses. There's a lot of percussion happening in the verses. There's just a lot of activity that I don't think like a three-man band can cater to.
Well, it's the same. It feels very similar to Wisconsin for me. Yeah. Where you hear that song and you think like, yeah, you could do like a reduced version of that song with three people, no problem. And then you actually try to do it, and it's so hard to get it to sound any good. You know, and it's Wisconsin, it's for not entirely different reasons, but there's crossover for sure, but it has its own challenges to overcome. But yeah, it's that weird thing where you would think that these songs that are kind of like cheery and three chords would be easy to simplify. Wisconsin is far from three chords, but it has it's you'd think it's easy to just do like a simple, charming version of Wisconsin, but it's incredibly difficult for some reason. And here's what's weird: Rain we can do with three people and it sounds great, and it totally lends itself well. Skies and Seas, you need like eight.
Yeah.
And to listen to it, you wouldn't think that, but there's little details like the lead vocals on this song and the harmony are both double tracked, like double or triple tracked. And so you have a really full vocal sound, but then when you just get two guys singing two part harmony live, you hear pitch issues much more easily, and it doesn't have that really smooth, even compressed presence that it has on a recording. So you just kind of have to sing better. So it's tough to sing better.
Yeah, that's hard. That's hard stuff.
Speaking of all of the tracks that are on this record, Rick, do we want to or on this song? You know, you guys know what I mean. Listeners know what I mean.
Well, I didn't you corrected yourself.
Well, okay. Well, do we want to listen to some of those? Their stems there, Rick?
You betcha. Yeah, do we want to maybe check out those vocals, speaking of the vocals and how they were double tracked? Dill, you were briefly, before we started recording, reminiscing about the recording session of this. Do you want to kind of touch on that quick?
Yeah, so these vocals were recorded in the pre-Luke time period. This is like 2014. We're at a place called Music Loft, which doesn't exist anymore, recording with Craig Erickson. And we decided, for vibe's sake, we wanted to record the lead vocal and the harmony vocal simultaneously, because it's like, we're a good band. That's what good bands do. It was obviously very challenging, but we eventually got there. It was also one of a handful of sessions that we did in the morning for some reason. Well, I think the reason was it felt better for us to like do a session in the morning and then go and have the rest of our day. I think that felt really cool. But I remember Riley and I were standing next to each other, side by side, not even looking at each other, side by side, singing these harmonies.
Did we even put like a separator between us?
Nope. Sure didn't.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. But we got her done. You know? It's on the record. But yeah, never would have done it like that, I think, again. And then, so then we recorded. We got at least two good takes all the way through the song, like that, and then we layered them over top of each other to give it a big part of what gives it more of its like Simon and Garfunkel sound or Beatles or something.
Yeah, here's what they sound like on their own.
January tastes like everything I hate about myself. Last night I was dreaming, the universe was kneeling at my feet.
I sound so young.
Yeah, we both do.
Yeah, here's the next part.
The morning came and swept me out of all the endless, overwhelming madness, the fantasies I tease.
Yeah.
Hey, could you play that one more time? Is there a lyric like flub in there?
Which part?
Where you just started it. Could we listen back again?
The morning came and swept me out of all the endless, overwhelming madness.
Right there. Oh, somebody said the, and like the majority of you were saying the.
The majority of you.
Endless, I'm pretty sure. Overwhelming, out of all the end.
Oh, maybe.
Oh, like the versus the?
Yeah, I hear somebody saying
the. Oh, got it.
It's possible.
The overwhelming madness.
Oh well, anyway. Too late.
Oh yeah, well. Yep. 6 everybody, years too late.
Yeah, we gotta. What do you call it? Withdraw our album or recall it? We gotta recall it.
Yeah.
Re-record it. Reprint it.
We'll issue.
We
yeah.
We gotta Kanye it.
Yeah. That's also just a tough melody, like all around, I think, to follow those intervals, both the melody and the harmony. I remember I was talking to our buddy Cameron, and he was talking to me about this song and saying he usually has a pretty good idea when he's listening to harmonies, like what's going on, and he can like kind of visualize it or whatever. And he says he has no visual of this song. Like once it gets into like it's da 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 do 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 do,
yeah,
he kind of loses track of it, but it's a cool thing for him.
Yeah.
Do
we want to check out these trombones?
Yeah. Tell us about the trombones, Riley.
Well, they are a brass instrument that you use a slide to adjust the length of the tube.
Interestingly, formerly known as a sack butt.
Indeed.
That was actually the old name for a trombone.
What?
Was
a sack. Really?
Sack butt. So most trombones don't have valves, but they all have the handle. I don't know what that's called. Is that the sack or the butt?
So if you ever have a trombone player that you don't like, you can just call him a sack butt blower. It's completely accurate, but it sounds really insulting.
Luke's looking
at
it.
Wow. Yeah. I am. A sack butt is a type of trombone from the Renaissance and Baroque eras, characterized by a telescopic slide that is used to vary the length of the
slide.
Tube.
It's the slide. It's not the sack or the butt. Come on, guys.
Yeah.
Anyway, I had a couple. Well, actually, which trombone players were these? Because we had a few different sessions.
This was Noah, Bryce, and Taylor, I think.
Yeah.
So did the three of them do those top voices together, and then Bryce went back and added the bass?
That could definitely be. Well, no, I've got trombones 1 and 3 and trombones 2 and 4.
Oh, it must have just been the two of them then.
It says Taylor in the notes. Hold on. Okay. So that's trombones 1 and 3.
Is that the natural room reverb?
Yep.
From the Kirkwood band room? Wow.
Sounds cool. Wait, no. Yeah, it is.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
No, it's not.
Oh.
Here, okay. And then here's trombones 2 and 4. So the bass trombone is a lot louder than the other one in there. But so I don't know who played what. I'm sure the bass one was Bryce because he had like the valve trombone with the deeper notes. But when you play them together, through the magic of part writing, it sounds like this.
Yeah. I love that.
It's nice. It's
great. Yeah.
I like a rig.
Yeah. So, if Beth is listening, there are no parallel fifths or octaves or double leading tones in those parts. You'll be glad to know. No one else cares, but oh well.
I care. What a guy.
Thanks. Aww. So yeah, those are the trombones. I don't know if they do something slightly different in the second part or not. Let's listen. Oh, hey. I don't think so.
No.
But yeah, those were pretty fun.
Hey, can we? Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. Go on.
Could we go to the end of the song and listen to Riley playing the harmonica and Riley playing the banjo?
Nice.
Because those are two instruments I bet a lot of people don't know Riley plays.
Yeah, I'll toss in the bass too, just so we have some reference. Let's see.
There you go.
What a riot.
Nice.
What an absolute riot.
And both of those were recorded like in your bedroom by your like Zoom portable recorder, just sitting on your desk or something, weren't they?
Yep. That's why you get that nice room reverb. I don't know, 8x10 foot room reverb.
Really adds a richness, I think.
Yeah.
You were laying that that banjo back a little bit at the beginning, whether you knew it or not. You were laying it back.
I don't think I knew it. Let's throw in the auxiliary percussion to see if I knew it. Here we go. There's some really nice percussion in this song, and here's a taste of it. Nice.
Well, compared to the bass, when we were just listening to the bass and the banjo, it sounded like you were laying it back. Once everything gets fully involved, I'm thinking the Firehouse Sub sandwich. You know how like you can have it like served fully involved. Anyway, once everything gets fully involved, I can't really tell what's going on. But
yeah,
there's a lot of textural things happening with the percussion, and that was a fun one to record. I remember being in Tim Kink's studio or G-Mix, and they just had a crate full of percussion instruments that I'd never played before, and just kind of digging around and hearing what sounded cool, and that's pretty much all that happened for the percussion on the song.
Well, it turned out great.
Yeah.
It did turn out great. Yeah.
And we spent, I remember spending a lot of time getting that hit at the end to sound right. Do you guys remember that? Yeah. Yeah.
Like throughout the whole band or just for the percussion?
Just for the guitar. Just that knock sound.
We tried to figure out how we wanted to end the song, you know, because there's like a tambourine hit. And I think, how does the actual guitar track end? Because I think we cut everything off and put a knocking sound in there with a bunch of reverb. But I mean,
that's the acoustic.
Yeah, so it's like a. Yeah, so the guitar does a big stroke on that downbeat.
Yeah.
But we took out everything playing a downbeat and just put that knocking sound in there. But yeah, we didn't know. It's like, do we have...
Yeah, there's like a...
Yeah.
Reverb on it. I don't see that in my stems here. We might have added that in the studio later.
We probably did. But yeah, we did. That was a little detail that we did labor over for quite a bit, how to...
Yeah.
How best to bring that song to a close, because it's like you're going into a total mood shift.
Mm-hmm.
The second dream song directly after this, so it's like standalone. I would say, yeah, everyone playing that downbeat sounds great. Or like if we just cut everything off and did like a knocking with no reverb to just be like a sudden hard stop. But I'm glad we went with that sound with reverb, because it. There was something like there was a sudden close to it, and you have some time to like wind down from that mood before that piano comes in the next track.
Do you remember that for a while we were considering doing something where the last hit would then keep it like turn into like a sort of not a metronome sound, but like a metronome type beat where the last hit would go boom, 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 go, go, go.
Yep.
And then slow down. And then like a heartbeat slowing down or something. And then that would like, those pulses would turn into the next dream song.
Like, yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah, we didn't end up making that happen.
Yeah, I think just no ideas for the next dream song were coming that could be built around that.
Yeah.
So we just decided to ditch the idea.
Yeah.
It's a cool idea that we should save though.
Oh. Yeah, yeah. True. Next time we do a two disc concept album,
or just any other full length, because they're all probably gonna end up being concepts by accident.
Oops. Yeah,
or on purpose.
Or on purpose,
or on purpose, or by purpose,
or bipolar. Yeah. What else is cool in this song that we'd want to listen to?
Well, I don't know if the recordings are really strangely dynamic for the organ, but it is a fun fact that this is the only Trees Reach song that has a real mic'd Hammond B3 organ, as opposed to one played on Dylan's Nord Electro 5D keyboard. Unfortunately, it's also like the first time Dylan had ever played an organ, and so it's the worst organ performance that will be on any Trees Reach song.
It's
super charming, but definitely not his finest hour. But it works very well for this song, I think.
Yeah.
But here's how it sounds on its own. We can just listen to a little taste of like maybe the end of the chorus going into the solo.
Sure.
It gets really quiet there. It's straight up baseball diamond. I mean, like, you might as
well. I love that sound.
You really take us out to the ball game with that one, Bill. Love it.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah, this song was a hoot to record. It was one of those ones where we kept adding stuff, and, like, the more we added, the funnier we thought it was. And it was, as Luke mentioned earlier, the song was originally called Mr. Foggerain, like MR dot Foggerain, one word.
Foggerain is called Foggerane.
Yeah.
That's how we were spelling
because, you know, when you listen to Out the Window at the Mr. Foggerain or whatever, I don't know. It's like, oh, who's Mr.
Sounds
Foggerain?
Like you're saying, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a while, like, we held on to that for a while before being like, yeah, we should probably rename this song.
Right.
But it was like,
it's
it was a
too much of a joke.
Title.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm glad we changed that.
But true fans will call it Mr. Foggerain from now on.
That's right. Yeah.
True fans.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, when we were trying to come up with a new title for this song, I was reading through Catcher in the Rye, and I got to that passage about the museum and the glass cages, and I said, how about we call this song Glass Cages? And we're like, it doesn't quite fit. And it doesn't, it's like from the same source material as that one line, but it doesn't actually pertain. And, but I thought it was a cool title. Mm-hmm. So then when we decided, hey, we want to do away with this whole repeat song, this old opening track, and write something new, I'm like, I'll write a song called Glass Cages. And so I did.
Wow.
So the title definitely, the title preceded the song, Glass Cages.
There you go.
Yep.
Wow. Prophetic, amazing, if you will.
Wow. I only have one more interesting fact about the recording of this, which was that the upright bass was recorded in a theater room at Cedar Valley Bible Church, like a back room where there's a bunch of storage of like costumes and such. I'm pretty sure it was like a Sunday after church. And we were using the same mic that we had used like for everything up like on the album, a cheap Sterling condenser mic. And it, we were just like, this will maybe work. And I think, in fact, I think Dylan was the one who had like Googled and figured out that that we wanted to put the mic right in front of the bridge of the instrument. And we did it, and I was like, there's like a very slim chance this is gonna work, like this is gonna sound any good, just because like it wasn't a mic designed to pick up low end. But the bass, like the recording that we got, sounds like shockingly good. At least to me, I'm very surprised at how full and even it sounds. Yep. For how like ramshackle of a process mm-hmm. it was to get that recording.
Yeah. Can you play a little clip of the upright?
Oh, yeah. But yeah,
it sounds really great. This was
a nice attack and decent amount of sustain and a pleasant wubbiness, pleasant little pillowy wub, you know.
Yeah. This was definitely before I like was playing upright, because there was that semester at Kirkwood when I was like actually taking lessons and playing in the jazz band.
This wasn't the same time.
This
was it at the same time?
This was mm-hmm. April 9th, 2017. So,
oh, okay.
This was like right before we were going into the, this is like a couple months before we went to the studio.
Okay.
So you had been in jazz band.
Okay. That would explain reason, why my pitch is pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's great. For some reason, I remember that. I remember it being like a year before that, but I guess it was the same spring summer that we mixed the album.
Yeah.
Yeah, cuz we did Kirkwood Jazz Band in 2016, right?
I think
it was 2016.
Yeah.
Wow. I think the room helped us out on that bass track because it was really small. It was an odd shape, and there was a ton of costumes hanging from the ceilings and like couches in there. So it was like it was an already small and then really additionally cramped room.
You're right.
And so all the sound was just tucked right into where we were standing.
In fact, that room would make a great vocal recording space.
Yeah. Oh. I think they might have moved the costumes out of there. But you know, things never stay the same in a high school.
Hey.
Oh, yeah.
Probably. That's probably true.
Is there a song in there?
A Frontier Ruckus Still? Song, maybe.
Yeah.
No, sorry.
There's probably already like 14 Frontier Ruckus songs that we haven't heard yet about that very thing.
Right.
Well, do you guys have any more to add about the recording process, the stems?
I don't think so.
I don't reckon.
Well, is there anything that you would What do you like about the song? Is there something that you change to help sell the vibe a little better, or are you happy with how it sounds?
Would it be done differently if we did it now? Yes. Would I do anything differently? No. I think the only things I'm hearing in this is that some of the tracks are from 6 years ago, and I can tell. But no, honestly, I think it's got a lot of charm. I think the song kind of speaks for itself. The one thing I still really like about it that I often take for granted is how satisfying and charming the choruses are. Like that melody that you wrote, Rick, for the "But the night is longer than the day" when she skies and sees away is just, I think, really intuitively good. And it's a good chord progression. The fact there's trombones in there and a ball game organ. And it's not a song we would do today. And so I'm glad that we recorded it and got it down and people can enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I could remember what it felt like when I was the most excited about this song. Cause like whenever you're working on new songs for a project, you'll always go through a period where, especially if it's a song that you've written, it's like the song that you're the most happy with and you love how it's going. And you're like, I can't wait for people to hear this. And so I remember that there was like, I think it was like summer 2015 when I was like putting in the banjo and harmonica, and like that current demo that we had, I was like, I'm super excited about this song. And like, I just love how the song makes me feel. And then by the time we mixed the album, like it was totally gone. And I sort of couldn't stand the song. I was like, I know that it's fine, but I'm just totally over it and I don't like it anymore. Now I'm indifferent and I'm like, it's a good song. It's kind of cringy at parts. We probably should have re-recorded the vocals. I think we tried to though, and they didn't sound as good. So who knows?
We did. Yeah, we did in my basement. We tried and it just
and they just sounded like really work. Energy. Like I think we probably should have gone for a cold swim beforehand or something. But,
yeah.
If I were to change things, they would just be, I don't know. It's like Dylan said, we wouldn't make a song like this now. So it's impossible to really like say if there's anything that I would just be like, oh yeah, like we should have done this way. I don't really have much to say in that department, other than I would love to hear this song for the first time again to remind myself what it was, like the spark that had me excited about it for when we were really doing the legwork finishing it.
I think it sounds best listened to in the fall or the winter, especially those trombones. It always makes me think of Christmas in an ancient traditional way. Not in a hokey way.
Like when they bring in brass instruments for church for like two Sundays a year.
Yeah. And it feels like a warm fire and a hot turkey and some wine. It really sounds great.
Hmm.
Yeah. So maybe try listening to it this Christmas and see if you feel any different about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's all I got.
All right. Well, thank y'all for tuning in to another episode of Dissecting with the Boys. Cool.
All right,
y'all. Well, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Have a great 2 weeks until then. Enjoy your lives. Enjoy music. Enjoy the people around you.
Amen.
But don't forget to wash your hands if you're around people, okay?
Yes, thank you.
There we go.
Please, guys, you, look Bill alive.
Man. Come on.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
All right. Good night, guys.